time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live here in the studios Will Potter. Will Potter is an award-winning independent journalist based in Washington, D.C., who focuses on eco-terrorism, the animal rights and environmental movements, and civil liberties post 9/11. His work has appeared in publications including the Chicago Tribune, the Dallas Morning News, Legal Affairs, the Chronicle of Higher Education, In These Times, the Texas Observer, and the Vermont Law Review. He has testified before the U.S. Congress on his reporting and frequently speaks with journalists and in public forums about efforts to roll back civil liberties in the name of fighting terrorism. And he is here to talk about his new book, Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Will, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
So to start out, tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Green is the New Red?
Well, for several years now, I've run a website called greenisthenewred.com, where I've been writing about these campaigns to label political activists as eco-terrorists and domestic terrorists. And with the book, I wanted to step back away from that and that style of writing and really delve into this in a narrative way, and also in a more investigative journalism way also. So in the book, I focus on the people involved. I mean, the people who have been affected by this, and part of it is bringing in my personal experiences as well, and mixing that with investigation into the history of these new terrorism laws, the corporations behind them, the political influence, the shift in law enforcement since the 80s and things like that.
All right. So how did you get interested and involved in this issue to begin with?
Well, I started paying attention to these so-called eco-terrorism laws when I was a reporter at the Texas Observer, which is a great magazine down in Austin. And I went and worked at the Chicago Tribune for a bit, and I was covering breaking news and blood and guts reporting and, shooting after shooting on the South Side, and it really left me feeling like this wasn't the type of journalism I wanted to be doing. I didn't feel like I was making any difference in the world. So I went out leafleting with some people that I met through mutual friends, and it was against leafleting about an animal testing company called Huntington Life Sciences. We went out leafleting in a residential neighborhood where an executive lived who was tied to the lab, and that's all we did. We hung door knockers. We were arrested, charged with disorderly conduct, which of course was all thrown out. But the important part of that story is that a couple weeks later, I had a knock on the door from two FBI agents who said that they knew all about the Fulbright I had pending, and my girlfriend at the time had PhD applications, and they knew all this personal information. They said, hey, we can make all this go away. And I said, well, what are you going to make go away? This is a Class C misdemeanor. There's no way this is going to stick. This is leafleting. They said, well, after 9/11, everything changed. We can put you on this domestic terrorism list unless you want to work with us and help learn about animal rights and environmental groups and essentially be an infiltrator. So that was really a turning point for me in a lot of ways. In the book, I write about how when you hear about stories like this, or at least I did, and you care about past social justice movements and you hear about what went on, I always like to think that if that happened to me, I wouldn't flinch. Like, I wouldn't show any fear. And it scared the daylights out of me. I mean, it really affected me personally, affected my relationship, affected my job. And it made me ashamed how much it made me concerned. But over time, that really became the start of an obsession and finding out how social movements who have never harmed a human being in their 30-plus year history became the FBI's number one domestic terrorism threat. And that's the path that eventually set me down, like you said, testified before Congress and got more and more immersed in this to the point where I decided to write this book.
So talk about the Shack 7. Is it that same organization that or group that you had initially been involved with?
Part of the same campaign against that notorious animal testing lab called Huntington Life Sciences, which had been exposed multiple times, with really outrageous undercover investigations, like punching beagle puppies in the face and dissecting live animals and just horrific, horrific footage. So the Shack 7, they were convicted of so-called animal enterprise terrorism and also conspiracy to stalk and conspiracy to harass using a telecommunications device. And what they did is they ran a very controversial website in which they publicly supported a wide range of tactics against this animal testing company. So there are people, I guess it would be people like me, who went out leafleting, other people who were protesting, other people writing letters, other people making phone calls. And Shaq made clear that if people wanted to go out and release animals from labs or if they destroyed property, they weren't going to turn their backs on that. All of that information went up on the website. And Shaq didn't facilitate it, and the government never argued that. And the government also never argued they had anything to do with the people who actually broke the law when that happened. But the government's case was based on the fact they ran this website and said these things, created a climate in which it allowed these illegal activities to take place. And on top of that, it caused a loss of profits for Huntington itself. And that was the case that was made against them. So it was truly a landmark First Amendment case in a couple of ways. I mean, not to get too legally here, but a really important First Amendment standard is from the Brandenburg case. It's the incitement standard. It says that you have the right to say really outrageous things up until the point it causes imminent and lawless action. So in other words, if we can talk on this radio show about either conspiracy theories or radical tactics or what we think needs to happen. But if I say, hey, Mike, what we need to do right now, we need to go out in the street and we need to go to this place and we need to, you know, set something on fire. That would probably cross the threshold. In the Shaq case, though, the one government witness was a teenager who sent black faxes and participated in an email civil disobedience campaign. So bombarding this company with emails. And the government said, how do you learn about this? And he said, well, I learned about it from the website. And the government said, well, you know, as soon as you saw this, did you go out and do it? And he said, no, I thought about it for a couple weeks. And then I decided to use my parents' computer and I got a phone card and, you know, all this kind of stuff. There's no imminent lawless action. This is weeks later. So it was really, to put a long story short, it was a key First Amendment case in arguing that you can hold people accountable for others' actions that aren't directly connected and that happen at some point in the distant future based on your words. And they were convicted as terrorists for between 1 and 6 years in prison. All of them are out now except one defendant, Kevin Jonas, is still there. And recently the Supreme Court declined to hear the case, which essentially means it's the end of the road. So this ruling continues to stand.
Why is Kevin Jonas still serving time while others aren't?
He had the highest sentence, the longest sentence of the group. Everyone had varying prison sentences. For instance, there's an activist in Seattle, Josh Harper, who got about 3 years in prison, and Kevin Jonas got a longer period of time, so he hasn't been released yet. He's probably got, I don't even know what month it is. I think he's got about 6 months left.
Was he more involved with the creation of the website, or, I mean, was there a reason?
Well, that was what was interesting in this case. The government pulled in a pretty wide range of people that I would argue have less to do with their level of involvement in the campaign and more to do with their leadership positions in the animal rights movement and also their positions geographically. So the activists who are actually charged under this very wide-ranging campaign that had people all over the country and, in fact, all over the world involved in it, were spread around the country. And I think a key part of that is to instill fear in their various communities. You know, whether or not they get convicted, when you have an activist in your community facing terrorism charges for something like this, it has an impact and it sends a message. And I think that's what this case was truly about. It sends a message. The fact that they got the conviction in some ways was just an added bonus and an added victory. But in either case, it helped instill that fear.
So you mentioned animal enterprise terrorism. Could you talk about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and how it came about?
Sure. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a new law that was passed in 2006 that testified against before Congress. Most people don't know about it except for the industries and the corporations who lobbied for it. So this law that we were just talking about that was used to convict that group of activists for their speech at the same time they were awaiting sentencing, the Justice Department, GlaxoSmithKline, and these other corporations were testifying alongside me before Congress saying, our hands are tied in going after extremists, ignoring what was going on with that most high-profile domestic terrorism investigation in the country, according to court documents. More wiretaps were used in the Shaq case than any other investigation at that time. So I would argue you had Justice Department officials lying and saying, our hands are tied, we don't have any power to go after these people, and we need a new law. Well, the new law goes even further than the previous version. It's so broad that it can wrap up nonviolent civil disobedience as terrorism if it does a couple things. It has to be targeting an animal enterprise, which is what it sounds like, you know, a fur farm, a circus, animal experimentation lab, a factory farm. Or this new law goes even further and says any business tied to an animal enterprise. So if you're a toilet paper supplier or a FedEx or UPS or any company like this, you would be protected under the law also. And it also says if you instill a reasonable fear in someone based on your activism. And one of the big things I talk about in the book is how really in this political climate, the unreasonable has become reasonable through ad campaigns, press conferences, terrorism rhetoric. So this sweeping law really, I think, is quite dangerous. The first time it was used was against a group of activists in California who didn't break windows, didn't steal animals from labs, didn't do anything like that. Their criminal complaint, filed by the government, said they did things including protesting while wearing bandanas over their faces, which activists do because they don't like to be photographed by corporate cops and FBI. They also chalked slogans on the sidewalk using children's sidewalk chalk. And they also allegedly chanted slogans, things like 1, 2, 3, 4, open up the cage door. And the government said all of this contributed to that climate of fear and put people in afraid who were there, who were being protested. And therefore, this was animal enterprise terrorism. Fortunately, this case was thrown out because of the work of some excellent attorneys and a pretty rare court ruling in which the judge sided with the defendants and didn't allow this to move forward. But it really set the tone of what the government's trying to do with these cases.
Have there been any other cases brought under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act?
There have been, and they, in contrast, have been for the types of things that ostensibly this law was meant to go after. Things like people who, two activists in Utah who released mink from fur farms. And that's all they did. I mean, they didn't burn anything down. They didn't harm anyone, but they went in and opened the cages based on their political beliefs and their moral beliefs, and released animals who were going to be turned into fur coats. And that was prosecuted as terrorism, and they were sentenced to prison as such. So that's the scope of what has been targeted through this new law.
Have there been expansions of that at the state level as well?
I don't know if I go so far as to call them expansions because it's just a different animal. But one thing I really found fascinating in researching the book, which I wasn't aware of, is how many states have, I'd call it designer legislation, specifically creating new crimes or new sentences or new restitution based on people's political beliefs, targeting animal rights and environmental activists. I think about 38 or 39 states have laws on the books just for these activists. And they say things, they're like the Crop Interference Protection Act and the agro-terrorism legislation and animal enterprise protection. This kind of language permeates them. Some of the most extreme are, there's one in Pennsylvania that's specifically an eco-terrorism law that's on the books. What most people don't know, though, and I didn't really know until working on this project, is a lot of this has been orchestrated by a right-wing group called the American Legislative Exchange Council. And real briefly, because I think people really need to know about this group, how it works is corporations pay tens of thousands of dollars to become members. Then ALEC holds conferences in which they invite state lawmakers, their state lawmaker members from around the country, And the state lawmakers do things like they have skeet shooting sponsored by the National Rifle Association. They go out to Broadway shows paid by corporations. They go out to fancy dinners in New York, wherever the conference is. And while they're out having fun, the corporations who paid to be members are actually drafting legislation. They draft model bills, which are then taken back to state houses around the country, introduced by those state lawmakers, and other state lawmakers have no idea these bills were actually drafted literally by corporations. And one of those bills is a model ecoterrorism law that fortunately has never been, to my knowledge, passed in full in any state, but they've been trying for quite some time. And it goes so far as to not only say civil disobedience is terrorism, but anyone who supports through their words, through websites, through leaflets, anyone who's been labeled an eco-terrorist is guilty of eco-terrorism. So that would be arguably someone like me, for sure, someone like you hosting this show. I mean, this is literally how broad this corporate legislation is written. And like I said, it hasn't been passed that way, but that's not the point. It's about really constantly pushing the limits and constantly trying to advance this agenda, whether or not these bills get passed, and a lot of them do, to inch forward and keep moving that needle.
And do you know any of the corporations that have worked on that and done so? And do they also work with other organizations, for instance, let's say universities or local nonprofit research organizations?
One thing that was surprising to me was I obtained the internal documents of this group called the Animal Enterprise Protection Coalition, which really, it was a front group that pushed for this federal law that we were talking about. And the list of supporters was quite surprising. It was all the usual suspects and heavily, heavily dominated by the pharmaceutical industry and biotech. But at the same time, it had, like you mentioned, the University of California system, because animal experimenters there had been protested and targeted, and there had been some property destruction that took place. So it was a wider group of corporations and interests than I personally had expected to see. The parallel with the state laws we were talking about is the pharmaceutical industry was also a very heavy player in that. And if folks don't know, I'm sure you do. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has more money than so many other political interests in a town like Washington, a town where everyone is throwing money at their projects. They're one of the heavy hitters, and they've shown that in the state legislative campaigns as well.
Yeah, I've seen studies where the pharmaceutical industry publicly says they put so much money into R&D, but I've seen studies that show that what they spend on sales and lobbying dwarf what they're putting into R&D.
So. Absolutely.
So talk more about the effects of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and surveillance. You mentioned the Shaq case that time that was set the record for the amount of wiretaps. Was that right?
Right.
So, and talk more about examples that you've run across. I understand even things like the recent movie Gasland got some federal attention.
And what's interesting about this, the surveillance model that's developed, is it's really moved away from what most people think of police work, you know, kind of burning shoe leather and knocking on doors and working the room, working leads, to become this, what some people I talked to described as a full pipe model. In other words, you're just vacuuming up just mounds of information and trying to filter through it. And part of that helps explain things like what you just mentioned. In Pennsylvania, the State Department of Homeland Security was exposed having hired a counterterrorism firm and been giving them tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop reports about activist threats and terrorist threats. And as part of that report, they profiled environmental groups who were attending film screenings of the movie Gasland. They also profiled animal rights activists who were protesting the use of carriage horses in Philadelphia, I believe. So this is the scope of conduct being wrapped up in terrorism surveillance. And if that sounds outrageous, and it is, how this came about is that there's been a steady flow of money coming in since 9/11 for so-called counterterrorism. But it's really been with little strings attached and also little training. So you have what are called fusion centers around the country that are meant to be clearinghouses for terrorism intelligence. But what I've found is a lot of people working there have no training per se in terrorism investigation. Certainly they lack training in civil liberties oversight and making sure people's rights are protected. On top of that, you have people being deputized essentially as terrorism officials with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. So all this is going on with very little checks and balances, and it results in things like this, these terrorism dossiers about documentaries.
And these fusion centers are conglomerates of local police forces, national police forces, private security firms. Is that true?
Right. It's a mix of all of those things meant to, I don't know if listeners remember several years ago, there was a huge controversy about intelligence sharing and whether or not that between FBI and Homeland Security and CIA and various law enforcement have contributed to different terrorism cases over the years, that lack of sharing. And this is part of that. It's meant to be sharing between state, local, federal law enforcement. And it's, I mean, clearly involves other political interests as well. In Pennsylvania, some of the documents that came out about this monitoring these activists in this film screening explained ties to Marcellus Shale, a huge company in the area. And they were very concerned about this movie and these protests because they were involved in fracking, which is, you know, natural gas extraction, which is what the movie was about. So it's not just terrorism cops. You know, they're clearly bringing other people to the table.
And as you just pointed out, people that don't have any experience, and I know getting back to a local example that we both had run across a document from a private security firm in anticipation. It was a conference here in Seattle. It was in anticipation of potential activists, protesters there, and it listed like six potential local leaders and had listed the name of a local woman who was, at the time, was the chair, the head of the University of Washington, SALDEF, the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund. And she had gotten the copy of the document eventually, too, and it said it was completely inaccurate.
Oh,
and this is what they're passing around to law enforcement people.
Well, not only is it inaccurate, but it includes things about who activists are dating in that particular file. It includes, you know, their activist history, you know, where they went to school and stuff that has no value other than to show the power of their surveillance operations. And then they're not even true. But I think the bigger concern with things like that is that it really shows, like you said, the lack of oversight and the lack of checks and balances on what's going on right now. And I think people, you know, regardless of how people feel about animal rights or environmental activists or some of the tactics people have used, that really is the driving point for me in this project, is that what's happening right now is an erosion of checks and balances on government power, an erosion of any oversight. It's a waste of taxpayer money. And it's also really this conflation of corporate and government interests. So with the reports like this, it's really become impossible to distinguish the extreme PR rhetoric and campaigns of corporations from official government policy. I mean, over the last 20 years, it's become completely impossible to distinguish them. They are one and the same. And it was very difficult trying to chart that trajectory for the book of how this all came about, because, you know, it kind of went viral in a way. I mean, no one knows where specifically why these policies came about, other than just these vested political interests over the years slowly chipped away, and eventually those interests dovetailed with government policy.
Yeah, I think it was from one of your pieces where I read that the Rainforest Action Network has been equated as being on par with Al-Qaeda.
And that's, unfortunately, things like that have shown up not just in PR campaigns, in sound bites and outrageous quotes in the press, but actually in government documents, too. in Homeland Security files, FBI files, the way the government is talking about these social movements, they have completely lost any perspective of the nature of this so-called threat and what these activists have actually been involved with.
And as one who reads, and I shouldn't because it just raises my blood pressure every time I do, the comment section in local papers and stuff, online comment section, it's clear that there is a sizable portion of the populace that believes these claims, for instance, Rainforest Action Network being the equivalent of Al-Qaeda, and when they are focusing their anger on groups or whatever for the current world woes, that creates a pretty scary situation. People talking about, you know, carrying out violence against these groups, these people.
Right. I mean, to put it another way, when you have a limited pot of government resources and time and law enforcement time, and it's being spent investigating animal rights and environmental groups and film screenings and comparing them to Al-Qaeda, it means by default those resources are not being spent investigating other threats. And in fact, in my research, I found a document from 2003 from the Inspector General of the Justice Department, did an audit of the FBI. And so I went through all these audits, and buried in one of them was a 2-page recommendation by the Justice Department to the FBI saying, stop targeting animal rights and environmental activists as eco-terrorists and terrorists. Stop doing it. It's a waste of law enforcement resources. Exactly what you just said. It takes attention away from more truly violent threats. It hinders public safety and the purpose of law enforcement. And the FBI simply wrote back that because of the amount of the growing influence of animal rights and environmental groups and the severity of some of these crimes, that they're in fact domestic terrorists and they refuse to compromise in that in any way. And to divert from that just real briefly, there are no new crimes being created that if someone blew up a building, blowing up a building is a crime. If someone stole animals, that's a crime. If someone spray painted a slogan on the street, that's a crime. What labeling this as terrorism does, it is increases the profile, increases the amount of resources that can be thrown at it, increases the attention for the prosecutors and the law enforcement involved, who I talked to a lot of former FBI who identify this as a path to career advancement. So those are the true benefits of doing that from their perspective.
And during this same period, while the government and corporations have been ratcheting up their focus on animal rights activists and environmental activists, people who were doing real harm, for instance, at abortion clinics and elsewhere, weren't being prosecuted or getting near the focus that these other groups were.
Well, even on the Department of Homeland Security's list of national security threats from a few years back, it doesn't even list any right-wing groups, but lists animal rights and environmental activists. The FBI went through all of their year-end terrorism reports from like the mid-90s to the latest one in 2005. And with the exception of, I think it's one or two bombings by Eric Rudolph, doesn't list any murders of abortion providers, doesn't list any KKK or Aryan Nation violence, doesn't list any attacks on mosques after September 11th, which continue to occur, and attacks on people because of their perceived ethnicity or political beliefs. So there's this glaring disconnection between the people who are actually using physical violence for political purposes and becoming more bold, and animal rights and environmental activists who haven't done anything like that.
Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. We're talking with Will Potter. He is author of the new book, Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And you also have a website, too, greenisthenewred.com.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.